On reaching it, the astonishment of my fellow servants to see me and their joy also was intense. And when they heard that their little mistress was safe, two or three were about to hurry up and shout the news at Mr. Edgar's door. But I bespoke the announcement of it myself. How changed I found him, even in those few days. He lay an image of sadness and resignation awaiting his death. Very young he looked, though his actual age was 39. One would have called him 10 years younger at least. He thought of Catherine, but he murmured her name. I touched his hand and spoke. "Catherine is coming, dear master," I whispered. "She is alive and well, and will be here, I hope, tonight." I trembled at the first effects of this intelligence. He half rose up, looked eagerly round the apartment, and then sank back in a swoon. As soon as he recovered, I related our compulsory visit and detention at the Heights. I said Heathcliff forced me to go in, which was not quite true. I uttered as little as possible against Linton, nor did I describe all his father's brutal conduct, my intentions being to add no bitterness, if I could help it, to his already overflowing cup. He divined that one of his enemy's purposes was to secure the personal property, as well as the estate, to his son, or rather himself. Yet why he did not wait till his decease was a puzzle to my master, because ignorant how nearly he and his nephew would quit the world together. However, he felt that his will had better be altered. Instead of leaving Catherine's fortune at her own disposal, he determined to put it in the hands of trustees for her use during life, and for her children, if she had any, after her. By that means, it could not fall to Mr. Heathcliff should Linton die. Having received his orders, I dispatched a man to fetch the attorney, and four more, provided with serviceable weapons to demand my young lady of her jailer. Both parties were delayed very late. The single servant returned first. He said Mr. Green, the lawyer, was out when he arrived at his house, and he had to wait 2 hours for his re-entrance. And then Mr. Green told him he had a little business in the village that must be done, but he would be at Thrushcross Grange before morning. The four men came back unaccompanied also. They brought word that Catherine was ill, too ill to quit her room, and Heathcliff would not suffer them to see her. I scolded the stupid fellows well for listening to that tale, which I would not carry to my master, resolving to take a whole bevy up to the Heights at daylight and storm it literally, unless the prisoner were quietly surrendered to us. Her father shall see her, I vowed and vowed again, if that devil be killed on his own doorstones in trying to prevent it. Happily, I was spared the journey and the trouble. I had gone downstairs at 3 o'clock to fetch a jug of water, and was passing through the hall with it in my hand, when a sharp knock at the front door made me jump. "Oh, it is Green," I said, recollecting myself. "Only Green." And I went on intending to send somebody else to open it, but the knock was repeated, not loud, and still importunately. I put the jug on the banister and hastened to admit him myself. The harvest moon shone clear outside. It was not the attorney. My own sweet little mistress sprang on my neck, sobbing.
"Ellen, Ellen, is Papa alive?"
"Yes," I cried.
"Yes, my angel, he is. God be thanked, you are safe with us again."
She wanted to run breathless as she was upstairs to Mr. Linton's room, but I compelled her to sit down on a chair and made her drink and washed her pale face, chafing it into a faint colour with my apron. Then I said I must go first and tell of her arrival, imploring her to say she should be happy with young Heathcliff. She stared, but soon comprehending why I counselled her to utter the falsehood, she assured me she would not complain. I couldn't abide to be present at their meeting. I stood outside the chamber door a quarter of an hour, and hardly ventured near the bed then. All was composed, however. Catherine's despair was as silent as her father's joy. She supported him calmly in appearance, and he fixed on her features his raised eyes that seemed dilating with ecstasy. "He died blissfully, Mr. Lockwood. He died so." Kissing her cheek, he murmured, "I am going to her, and you, darling child, shall come to us." And never stirred or spoke again, but continued that rapt, radiant gaze till his pulse imperceptibly stopped and his soul departed. None could have noticed the exact minute of his death. It was so entirely without a struggle. Whether Catherine had spent her tears or whether the grief were too weighty to let them flow, she sat there dry-eyed till the sun rose. She sat till noon, and would still have remained brooding over that deathbed, but I insisted on her coming away and taking some repose. It was well I succeeded in removing her, for at dinner time appeared the lawyer, having called at Wuthering Heights to get his instructions how to behave. He had sold himself to Mr. Heathcliff. That was the cause of his delay in obeying my master's summons. Fortunately, no thought of worldly affairs crossed the latter's mind to disturb him after his daughter's arrival. Mr. Green took upon himself to order everything and everybody about the place. He gave all the servants but me notice to quit. He would have carried his delegated authority to the point of insisting that Edgar Linton should not be buried beside his wife, but in the chapel with his family. There was the will, however, to hinder that, and my loud protestations against any infringement of its directions. The funeral was hurried over. Catherine, Mrs. Linton Heathcliff now, was suffered to stay at the Grange till her father's corpse had quitted it. She told me that her anguish had at last spurred Linton to incur the risk of liberating her. She heard the men I sent disputing at the door, and she gathered the sense of Heathcliff's answer. It drove her desperate. Linton, who had been conveyed up to the little parlour soon after I left, was terrified into fetching the key before his father reascended. He had the cunning to unlock and relock the door without shutting it, and when he should have gone to bed, he begged to sleep with Hareton, and his petition was granted for once. Catherine stole out before break of day. She dared not try the doors, lest the dog should raise an alarm. She visited the empty chambers and examined their windows, and luckily, lighting on her mother's, she got easily out of its lattice and onto the ground, by means of the fir tree close by. Her accomplice suffered for his share in the escape, notwithstanding his timid contrivances. Chapter 29. The evening after the funeral, my young lady and I were seated in the library, now musing mournfully, one of us despairingly, on our loss, now venturing conjectures as to the gloomy future. We had just agreed the best destiny which could await Catherine would be a permission to continue resident at the Grange, at least during Linton's life, he being allowed to join her there and I to remain as housekeeper. That seemed rather too favourable an arrangement to be hoped for, and yet I did hope, and began to cheer up under the prospect of retaining my home and my employment, and above all, my beloved young mistress. When a servant, one of the discarded ones not yet departed, rushed hastily in and said, "That devil Heathcliff was coming through the court, should he fasten the door in his face?" If we had been mad enough to order that proceeding, we had not time. He made no ceremony of knocking or announcing his name. He was master, and availed himself of the master's privilege to walk straight in without saying a word. The sound of our informant's voice directed him to the library. He entered, and motioning him out, shut the door. It was the same room into which he had been ushered as a guest 18 years before. The same moon shone through the window, and the same autumn landscape lay outside. We had not yet lighted a candle, but all the apartment was visible, even to the portraits on the wall. The splendid head of Mrs. Linton, and the graceful one of her husband. Heathcliff advanced to the hearth. Time had little altered his person either. There was the same man, his dark face rather sallower and more composed, his frame a stone or two heavier, perhaps, and no other difference. Catherine had risen with an impulse to dash out when she saw him.
"Stop,"
he said, arresting her by the arm.
"No more runnings away. Where would you go? I'm come to fetch you home, and I hope you'll be a dutiful daughter and not encourage my son to further disobedience." I was embarrassed how to punish him when I discovered his part in the business. He's such a cobweb. A pinch would annihilate him. But you'll see by his look that he has received his due. I brought him down one evening, the day before yesterday, and just set him in a chair and never touched him afterwards. I sent Hareton out and we had the room to ourselves. In 2 hours I called Joseph to carry him up again. And since then my presence is as potent on his nerves as a ghost. And I fancy he sees me often, though I am not near. Hareton says he wakes and shrieks in the night by the hour together, and calls you to protect him from me. And, whether you like your precious mate or not, you must come. He's your concern now. I yield all my interest in him to you.
Why not let Catherine continue here? I pleaded. And send Master Linton to her, as you hate them both. You'd not miss them. They can only be a daily plague to your unnatural heart.
I'm seeking a tenant for the Grange, he answered. And I want my children about me, to be sure. Besides, that lass owes me her services for her bread. I'm not going to nurture her in luxury and idleness after Linton is gone. Make haste and get ready now, and don't oblige me to compel you.
I shall, said Catherine. Linton is all I have to love in the world, and though you have done what you could to make him hateful to me and me to him, you cannot make us hate each other. And I defy you to hurt him when I am by, and I defy you to frighten me.
You are a boastful champion, replied Heathcliff. But I don't like you well enough to hurt him. You shall get the full benefit of the torment as long as it lasts. It is not I who will make him hateful to you. It is his own sweet spirit. He's as bitter as gall at your desertion and its consequences. Don't expect thanks for this noble devotion. I heard him draw a pleasant picture to Zillah of what he would do if he were as strong as I. The inclination is there, and his very weakness will sharpen his wits to find a substitute for strength.
I know he has a bad nature, said Catherine. He's your son, but I'm glad I've a better to forgive it, and I know he loves me, and for that reason I love him. Mr. Heathcliff, you have nobody to love you. And however miserable you make us, we shall still have the revenge of thinking that your cruelty arises from your greater misery. You are miserable, are you not? Lonely like the devil and envious like him. Nobody loves you. Nobody will cry for you when you die. I wouldn't be you. Catherine spoke with a kind of dreary triumph. She seemed to have made up her mind to enter into the spirit of her future family, and draw pleasure from the griefs of her enemies.
You shall be sorry to be yourself presently, said her father-in-law. If you stand there another minute, begone, witch, and get your things.
She scornfully withdrew. In her absence, I began to beg for Zillah's place at the Heights, offering to resign mine to her, but he would suffer it in no account. He bid me silent, and then for the first time allowed himself a glance round the room and a look at the pictures. Having studied Mrs. Linton's, he said,
I shall have that home. Not because I need it, but...
He turned abruptly to the fire and continued, with what, for lack of a better word, I must call a smile.
I'll tell you what I did yesterday. I got the sexton who was digging Linton's grave to remove the earth off her coffin lid, and I opened it. I thought once I would have stayed there, when I saw her face again. It is hers yet. He had hard work to stir me, but he said it would change if the air blew on it, and so I struck one side of the coffin loose and covered it up. Not Linton's side, damn him. I wish he'd been soldered in lead, and I bribed the sexton to pull it away when I'm laid there, and slide mine out too. I'll have it made so, and then by the time Linton gets to us, he'll not know which is which.
You were very wicked, Mr. Heathcliff, I exclaimed. Were you not ashamed to disturb the dead?
I disturb nobody, Nelly, he replied, and I gave some ease to myself. I shall be a great deal more comfortable now, and you'll have a better chance of keeping me underground when I get there. Disturbed her? No, she has disturbed me night and day through 18 years. Incessantly, remorselessly. Till yesternight, and yesternight I was tranquil. I dreamt I was sleeping the last sleep by that sleeper, with my heart stopped and my cheek frozen against hers. And if she had been dissolved into earth or worse, what would you have dreamt of then? I said. Of dissolving with her and being more happy still. He answered. Do you suppose I dread any change of that sort? I expected such a transformation on raising the lid, but I'm better pleased that it should not commence till I share it. Besides, unless I had received a distinct impression of her passionless features, that strange feeling would hardly have been removed. It began oddly. You know I was wild after she died, and eternally from dawn to dawn praying her to return to me, her spirit. I have a strong faith in ghosts. I have a conviction that they can and do exist among us. The day she was buried, there came a fall of snow. In the evening I went to the churchyard. It blew bleak as winter, all round was solitary. I didn't fear that her fool of a husband would wander up the glen so late, and no one else had business to bring them there. Being alone and conscious 2 yards of loose earth was the sole barrier between us. I said to myself, I'll have her in my arms again. If she be cold, I'll think it is this north wind that chills me, and if she be motionless, it is sleep. I got a spade from the tool house and began to delve with all my might. It scraped the coffin. I fell to work with my hands. The wood commenced cracking about the screws. I was on the point of attaining my object, when it seemed that I heard a sigh from someone above, close at the edge of the grave, and bending down. If I can only just get this off, I muttered. I wish they may shovel in the earth over us both. And I wrenched it more desperately still. There was another sigh close at my ear. I appeared to feel the warm breath of it displacing the sleet-laden wind. I knew no living thing in flesh and blood was by, but as certainly as you perceive the approach to some substantial body in the dark, though it cannot be discerned, so certainly I felt that Kathy was there, not under me, but on the earth. A sudden sense of relief flowed from my heart through every limb. I relinquished my labour of agony and turned, consoled at once, unspeakably consoled. Her presence was with me. It remained while I refilled the grave and led me home. You may laugh if you will, but I was sure I should see her there. I was sure she was with me, and I could not help talking to her. Having reached the heights, I rushed eagerly to the door. It was fastened, and I remember that accursed Earnshaw and my wife opposed my entrance. I remember stopping to kick the breath out of him, and then hurrying upstairs to my room and hers. I looked round impatiently. I felt her by me. I could almost see her, and yet I could not. I ought to have sweat blood then, from the anguish of my yearning, from the fervour of my supplications to have but one glimpse. I had not one. She showed herself, as she often was in life, a devil to me, and since then sometimes more and sometimes less, I've been the sport of that intolerable torture, infernal, keeping my nerves at such a stretch that if they had not resembled catgut, they would long ago have relaxed to the feebleness of Linton's. When I sat in the house with Hareton, it seemed that on going out I should meet her. When I walked on the moors, I should meet her coming. When I went from home, I hastened to return. She must be somewhere at the heights, I was certain. And when I slept in her chamber, I was beaten out of that. I couldn't lie there, for the moment I closed my eyes, she was either outside the window, or sliding back the panels, or entering the room, or even resting her darling head on the same pillow as she did when a child. And I must open my lids to see. And so I opened and closed them 100 times a night, to be always disappointed. It racked me. I've often groaned aloud, till that old rascal Joseph no doubt believed that my conscience was playing the fiend inside of me. Now, since I've seen her, I'm pacified. A little. It was a strange way of killing, not by inches but by fractions of hairbreadths, to beguile me with a spectre of a hope through 18 years. Mr. Heathcliff paused and wiped his forehead. His hair clung to it, wet with perspiration. His eyes were fixed on the red embers of the fire, the brows not contracted, but raised next the temples. Diminishing the grim aspect of his countenance, but imparting a peculiar look of trouble and a painful appearance of mental tension towards one absorbing subject. He only half addressed me, and I maintained silence. I didn't like to hear him talk. After a short period, he resumed his meditation on the picture, took it down and leant it against the sofa to contemplate it at a better advantage. And while so occupied, Catherine entered, announcing that she was ready, when her pony should be saddled. "Send that over tomorrow," said Heathcliff to me. Then turning to her, he added, "You may do without your pony. It is a fine evening, and you'll need no ponies at Wuthering Heights. For what journeys you take, your own feet will serve you. Come along."
"Goodbye, Ellen," whispered my dear little mistress. As she kissed me, her lips felt ice cold. "Come and see me, Ellen. Don't forget."
"Take care you do no such thing, Mrs. Dean," said her new father. "When I wish to speak to you, I'll come here. I want none of your prying at my house."
He signed her to precede him, and casting back a look that cut my heart, she obeyed. I watched them from the window walk down the garden. Heathcliff fixed Catherine's arm under his, though she disputed the act at first, evidently, and with rapid strides, he hurried her into the alley, whose trees concealed them. Chapter 30. I have paid a visit to the Heights, but I have not seen her since she left. Joseph held the door in his hand when I called to ask after her, and wouldn't let me pass. He said Mrs. Linton was thrang, and the master was not in. Zillah has told me something of the way they go on, otherwise I should hardly know who was dead and who living. She thinks Catherine haughty and does not like her. I can guess by her talk. My young lady asked some aid of her when she first came, but Mr. Heathcliff told her to follow her own business and let his daughter-in-law look after herself, and Zillah willingly acquiesced, being a narrow-minded, selfish woman. Catherine evinced a child's annoyance at this neglect, repaid it with contempt, and thus enlisted my informant among her enemies as securely as if she had done her some great wrong. I had a long talk with Zillah about 6 weeks ago, a little before you came, one day when we foregathered on the moor, and this is what she told me. "The first thing Mrs. Linton did," she said, "on her arrival at the Heights, was to run upstairs without even wishing good evening to me and Joseph. She shut herself into Linton's room and remained till morning. Then, while the master and Earnshaw were at breakfast, she entered the house and asked all in a quiver if the doctor might be sent for. Her cousin was very ill."
"We know that," answered Heathcliff, "but his life is not worth a farthing, and I won't spend a farthing on him."
"But I cannot tell how to do," said she, "and if nobody will help me, he'll die."
"Walk out of the room,"
cried the master,
"and let me never hear a word more about him. None here care what becomes of him. If you do, act the nurse. If you do not, lock him up and leave him."
Then she began to bother me, and I said I'd had enough plague with the tiresome thing. We each had our tasks, and hers was to wait on Linton. Mr. Heathcliff bid me leave that labour to her. How they managed together, I can't tell. I fancied he fretted a great deal, and moaned his cell night and day, and she had precious little rest, one could guess by her white face and heavy eyes. She sometimes came into the kitchen all wildered-like, and looked as if she would fain beg assistance, but I was not going to disobey the master. I never dare disobey him, Mrs. Dean, and though I thought it wrong that Kenneth should not be sent for, it was no concern of mine either to advise or complain, and I always refused to meddle. Once or twice after we had gone to bed, I've happened to open my door again and seen her sitting crying on the stairs top, and then I've shut myself in quick for fear of being moved to interfere. I did pity her then, I'm sure. Still, I didn't wish to lose my place, you know. At last one night she came boldly into my chamber and frightened me out of my wits by saying,
"Tell Mr. Heathcliff that his son is dying. I'm sure he is this time. Get up instantly and tell him."
Having uttered this speech, she vanished again. I lay a quarter of an hour listening and trembling. Nothing stirred. The house was quiet. "She's mistaken," I said to myself. "He's got over it. I needn't disturb them." And I began to doze. But my sleep was marred a second time by a sharp ringing of the bell, the only bell we have, put up on purpose for Linton. And the master called me to see what was the matter and informed them that he wouldn't have the noise repeated. I delivered Catherine's message. He cursed to himself and in a few minutes came out with a lighted candle and proceeded to their room. I followed. Mrs. Heathcliff was seated by the bedside with her hands folded on her knees. Her father-in-law went up, held the light to Linton's face, looked at him and touched him. Afterwards, he turned to her.
"Now, Catherine," he said, "how do you feel?"
She was dumb.
"How do you feel, Catherine?" he repeated.
"He's safe and I'm free," she answered. "I should feel well, but..."
She continued with a bitterness she couldn't conceal.
"You have left me so long to struggle against death alone that I feel and see only death. I feel like death."
And she looked like it too. I gave her a little wine. Hareton and Joseph, who had been wakened by the ringing and the sound of feet and heard our talk from outside, now entered. Joseph was fain, I believe, of the lad's removal. Hareton seemed a thought bothered, though he was more taken up with staring at Catherine than thinking of Linton. But the master bid him get off to bed again. We didn't want his help. He afterwards made Joseph remove the body to his chamber and told me to return to mine, and Mrs. Heathcliff remained by herself. In the morning he sent me to tell her she must come down to breakfast. She had undressed and appeared going to sleep, and said she was ill, at which I hardly wondered. I informed Mr. Heathcliff, and he replied,
"We'll let her be till after the funeral, and go up now and then to get her what is needful. And as soon as she seems better, tell me."
Kathy stayed upstairs a fortnight, according to Zillah, who visited her twice a day and would have been rather more friendly, but her attempts at increasing kindness were proudly and promptly repelled. Heathcliff went up once to show her Linton's will. He had bequeathed the whole of his and what had been her movable property to his father. The poor creature was threatened or coaxed into that act during her week's absence when his uncle died. The lands being a minor, he could not meddle with. However, Mr. Heathcliff has claimed and kept them in his wife's right and his also. I suppose, legally at any rate, Catherine, destitute of cash and friends, cannot disturb his possession.
"Nobody," said Zillah, "ever approached her door except that once but I, and nobody asked anything about her. The first occasion of her coming down into the house was on a Sunday afternoon. She had cried out when I carried up her dinner that she couldn't bear any longer being in the cold, and I told her the master was going to Thrushcross Grange, and Earnshaw and I needn't hinder her from descending. So, as soon as she heard Heathcliff's horse trot off, she made her appearance, donned in black, and her yellow curls combed back behind her ears, as plain as a Quaker. She couldn't comb them out."
Joseph and I generally go to chapel on Sundays. The kirk, you know, has no minister now, explained Mrs. Dean. And they call the Methodists or Baptists' place, I can't say which it is, at Gimmerton a chapel. "Joseph had gone," she continued, "but I thought proper to bide at home. Young folks are always the better for an elder's overlooking, and Hareton, with all his bashfulness, isn't a model of nice behaviour. I let him know that his cousin would very likely sit with us, and she had been always used to see the Sabbath respected, so he had as good leave his guns and bits of indoor work alone while she stayed. He coloured up at the news and cast his eyes over his hands and clothes. The train oil and gunpowder were shoved out of sight in a minute. I saw he meant to give her his company, and I guessed by his way he wanted to be presentable. So, laughing, as I durst not laugh when the master is by, I offered to help him, if he would, and joked at his confusion. He grew sullen and began to swear. 'Now, Mrs. Dean,' Zillah went on, seeing me not pleased by her manner, 'you happen to think your young lady too fine for Mr. Hareton, and happen you're right, but I own I should love well to bring her pride a peg lower.
And what will all her learning and her daintiness do for her now? She's as poor as you or I, poorer, I'll be bound. You're saying and I'm doing my little all that road.
Hareton allowed Zilla to give him her aid, and she flattered him into a good humour. So when Catherine came, half forgetting her former insults, he tried to make himself agreeable by the housekeeper's account.
Mrs. Walkton,
she said,
as chill as an icicle and as high as a princess, I got up and offered her my seat in the armchair. No, she turned up her nose at my civility. Earnshaw rose too and bid her come to the settle and sit close by the fire. He was sure she was starved.
I've been starved a month and more, she answered, resting on the word as scornful as she could, and she got a chair for herself and placed it at a distance from both of us. Having sat till she was warm, she began to look round and discovered a number of books on the dresser. She was instantly upon her feet again, stretching to reach them, but they were too high up. Her cousin, after watching her endeavours a while, at last summoned courage to help her. She held her frock and he filled it with the first that came to hand. That was a great advance for the lad. She didn't thank him. Still, he felt gratified that she had accepted his assistance and ventured to stand behind as she examined them, and even to stoop and point out what struck his fancy in certain old pictures which they contained, nor was he daunted by the saucy style in which she jerked the page from his finger. He contented himself with going a bit farther back and looking at her instead of the book. She continued reading or seeking for something to read. His attention became by degrees quite centred in the study of her thick silky curls, her face he couldn't see, and she couldn't see him. And perhaps not quite awake to what he did, but attracted like a child to a candle, at last he proceeded from staring to touching. He put out his hand and stroked one curl as gently as if it were a bird. He might have stuck a knife into her neck. She started round in such a taking.
"Get away this moment! How dare you touch me! Why are you stopping there?" she cried in a tone of disgust. "I can't endure you! I'll go upstairs again if you come near me."
Mr. Hareton recoiled, looking as foolish as he could do. He sat down in the settle, very quiet, and she continued turning over her volumes another half hour. Finally, Earnshaw crossed over and whispered to me, "Will you ask her to read to us, Zilla? I'm stalled of doing that, and I could like to hear her. Dunna say I wanted it, but ask of yourself."
"Mr. Hareton wishes you would read to us, ma'am," I said immediately. "He'd take it very kind, he'd be much obliged."
She frowned and, looking up, answered, "Mr. Hareton and the whole set of you will be good enough to understand that I reject any pretense at kindness you have the hypocrisy to offer. I despise you and will have nothing to say to any of you. When I would have given my life for one kind word, even to see one of your faces, you all kept off. But I won't complain to you. I'm driven down here by the cold, not either to amuse you or enjoy your society." "What could I have done?" began Earnshaw. "How was I to blame?"
"Oh, you are an exception,"
answered Mrs. Heathcliff. "I never missed such a concern as you."
"But I offered more than once and asked,"
he said, kindling up at her pertness.
"I asked Mr. Heathcliff to let me work for you."
"Be silent.
I'll go out of doors or anywhere rather than have your disagreeable voice in my ear," said milady.
Hareton muttered she might go to hell for him, and unslinging his gun, restrained himself from his Sunday occupations no longer. He talked now freely enough, and she presently saw fit to retreat to her solitude, but the frost had set in, and in spite of her pride, she was forced to condescend to our company more and more. However, I took care there should be no further scorning at my good nature. Ever since, I've been as stiff as herself, and she has no lover or liker among us, and she does not deserve one. For let them say the least word to her, and she'll curl back without respect of anyone. She'll snap at the master himself, and as good as dares him to thrash her, and the more hurt she gets, the more venomous she grows. At first, on hearing this account from Zilla, I determined to leave my situation, take a cottage, and get Catherine to come and live with me. But Mr. Heathcliff would as soon permit that as he would set up Hareton in an independent house, and I can see no remedy at present, unless she could marry again, and that scheme it does not come within my province to arrange.
Thus ended Mrs. Dean's story, notwithstanding the doctor's prophecy. I am rapidly recovering strength, and though it be only the second week in January, I propose getting out on horseback in a day or two, and riding over to Wuthering Heights to inform my landlord that I shall spend the next 6 months in London, and if he likes, he may look out for another tenant to take the place after October. I would not pass another winter here for much.
Chapter 31.
Yesterday was bright, calm and frosty. I went to the Heights as I proposed. My housekeeper entreated me to bear a little note from her to her young lady, and I did not refuse, for the worthy woman was not conscious of anything odd in her request. The front door stood open, but the jealous gate was fastened, as at my last visit. I knocked and invoked Earnshaw from among the garden beds. He unchained it, and I entered. The fellow is as handsome a rustic as need be seen. I took particular notice of him this time, but then he does his best, apparently, to make the least of his advantages. I asked if Mr. Heathcliff were home. He answered no, but he would be in at dinner time. It was 11 o'clock, and I announced my intention of going in and waiting for him, at which he immediately flung down his tools and accompanied me, in the office of watchdog, not as a substitute for the host. We entered together. Catherine was there, making herself useful in preparing some vegetables for the approaching meal. She looked more sulky and less spirited than when I had seen her first. She hardly raised her eyes to notice me, and continued her employment with the same disregard to common forms of politeness as before, never returning my bow and good morning by the slightest acknowledgement. She does not seem so amiable, I thought, as Mrs. Dean would persuade me to believe. She's a beauty, it is true, but not an angel. Earnshaw surlily bid her remove her things to the kitchen.
"Remove them yourself," she said, pushing them from her as soon as she had done, and retiring to a stool by the window, where she began to carve figures of birds and beasts out of the turnip parings in her lap.
I approached her, pretending to desire a view of the garden, and, as I fancied, adroitly dropped Mrs. Dean's note onto her knee, unnoticed by Hareton. But she asked aloud, "What is that?" and chucked it off. "A letter from your old acquaintance, the housekeeper at the Grange," I answered, annoyed at her exposing my kind deed, and fearful lest it should be imagined a missive of my own. She would gladly have gathered it up at this information, but Hareton beat her. He seized and put it in his waistcoat, saying Mr. Heathcliff should look at it first. Thereat, Catherine silently turned her face from us, and very stealthily drew out her pocket handkerchief and applied it to her eyes. And her cousin, after struggling a while to keep down his softer feelings, pulled out the letter and flung it onto the floor beside her as ungraciously as he could. Catherine caught and perused it eagerly. Then she put a few questions to me concerning the inmates, rational and irrational, of her former home, and gazing towards the hills, murmured in soliloquy,
"I should like to be riding Minnie down there. I should like to be climbing up there. Oh, I'm tired. I'm stalled, Hareton." And she leant her pretty head back against the sill, with half a yawn and half a sigh, and lapsed into an aspect of abstracted sadness, neither caring nor knowing whether we remarked her.
"Mrs. Heathcliff," I said, after sitting some time mute, "you are not aware that I am an acquaintance of yours? So intimate that I think it strange you won't come and speak to me. My housekeeper never wearies of talking about and praising you, and she'll be greatly disappointed if I return with no news of or from you, except that you received her letter and said nothing." She appeared to wonder at this speech and asked,
"Does Ellen like you?"
"Yes, very well," I replied hesitatingly.
"You must tell her," she continued, "that I would answer her letter, but I have no materials for writing.
not even a book from which I might tear a leaf.
No books? I exclaimed. How do you contrive to live here without them?
If I may take the liberty to inquire, though provided with a large library, I'm frequently very dull at the Grange. Take my books away and I should be desperate.
I was always reading when I had them, said Catherine. And Mr. Heathcliff never reads, so he took it into his head to destroy my books. I have not had a glimpse of one for weeks. Only once I searched through Joseph's store of theology, to his great irritation, and once, Hareton, I came upon a secret stock in your room. Some Latin and Greek, and some tales and poetry. All old friends I brought the last here. And you gathered them as a magpie gathers silver spoons, for the mere love of stealing. They are of no use to you, or else you concealed them in the bad spirit that, as you cannot enjoy them, nobody else shall. Perhaps your envy counselled Mr. Heathcliff to rob me of my treasures. But I've most of them written on my brain and printed in my heart, and you cannot deprive me of those.
Earnshaw blushed crimson when his cousin made this revelation of his private literary accumulations, and stammered an indignant denial of her accusations.
Mr. Hareton is desirous of increasing his amount of knowledge, I said, coming to his rescue. He is not envious, but emulous of your attainments. He'll be a clever scholar in a few years.
And he wants me to sink into a dunce meantime, answered Catherine. Yes, I hear him trying to spell and read himself, and pretty blunders he makes. I wish you would repeat Chevy Chase as you did yesterday. It was extremely funny. I heard you, and I heard you turning over the dictionary to seek out the hard words and then cursing because you couldn't read their explanations.
The young man evidently thought it too bad that he should be laughed at for his ignorance, and then laughed at for trying to remove it. I had a similar notion, and remembering Mrs. Dean's anecdote of his first attempt at enlightening the darkness in which he had been reared, I observed, "But, Mrs. Heathcliff, we have each had a commencement, and each stumbled and tottered on the threshold. Had our teachers scorned instead of aiding us, we should stumble and totter yet."
"Oh," she replied, "I don't wish to limit his acquirements. Still, he has no right to appropriate what is mine and make it ridiculous to me with his vile mistakes and mispronunciations. Those books, both prose and verse, are consecrated to me by other associations, and I hate to have them debased and profaned in his mouth. Besides, of all, he has selected my favourite pieces that I love the most to repeat, as if out of deliberate malice."
Hareton's chest heaved in silence a minute. He laboured under a severe sense of mortification and wrath, which it was no easy task to suppress. I rose, and from a gentlemanly idea of relieving his embarrassment, took up my station in the doorway, surveying the external prospect as I stood. He followed my example and left the room, but presently reappeared, bearing half a dozen volumes in his hands, which he threw into Catherine's lap, exclaiming,
"Take them. I never want to hear or read or think of them again."
"I won't have them now," she answered. "I shall connect them with you and hate them."
She opened one that had obviously been often turned over, and read a portion in the drawling tone of a beginner, then laughed and threw it from her.
"And listen," she continued provokingly, commencing a verse of an old ballad in the same fashion.
But his self-love would endure no further torment. I heard, and not altogether disapprovingly, a manual check given to her saucy tongue. The little wretch had done her utmost to hurt her cousin's sensitive, though uncultivated, feelings, and a physical argument was the only mode he had of balancing the account and repaying its effects on the inflictor. He afterwards gathered the books and hurled them on the fire. I read in his countenance what anguish it was to offer that sacrifice to spleen. I fancied that, as they consumed, he recalled the pleasure they had already imparted, and the triumph and ever-increasing pleasure he had anticipated from them. And I fancied, I guessed the incitement to his secret studies also.
He had been content with daily labour and rough animal enjoyments, till Catherine crossed his path. Shame at her scorn and hope of her approval were his first prompters to higher pursuits. And instead of guarding him from one and winning him to the other, his endeavours to raise himself had produced just the contrary result.
"Yes, that's all the good such a brute as you can get from them,"
cried Catherine, sucking her damaged lip and watching the conflagration with indignant eyes. "You'd better hold your tongue now," he said fiercely. And his agitation precluded further speech. He advanced hastily to the entrance, where I made way for him to pass. But ere he had crossed the doorstones, Mr. Heathcliff, coming up the causeway, encountered him, and laying hold of his shoulder, asked, "What's to do now, my lad?"
Not, he said, and broke away to enjoy his grief and anger in solitude. Heathcliff gazed after him and sighed. "It will be odd if I thwart myself," he muttered, unconscious that I was behind him. "But when I look for his father in his face, I find her every day more. How the devil is he so like? I can hardly bear to see him."
He bent his eyes to the ground and walked moodily in. There was a restless, anxious expression in his countenance. I had never remarked there before, and he looked sparer in person. His daughter-in-law, on perceiving him through the window, immediately escaped to the kitchen, so that I remained alone.
"I'm glad to see you out of doors again, Mr. Lockwood," he said, in replying to my greeting. "From selfish motives, partly. I don't think I could readily supply your loss in this desolation. I've wondered more than once what brought you here."
"An idle whim, I fear, sir," was my answer. "Or else an idle whim is going to spirit me away. I shall set out for London next week, and I must give you warning that I feel no disposition to retain Thrushcross Grange beyond the 12 months I agreed to rent it. I believe I shall not live there any more."
"Oh, indeed, you're tired of being banished from the world, are you?" he said. "But if you be coming to plead off paying for a place you won't occupy, your journey is useless. I never relent in exacting my due from anyone."
"I'm coming to plead of nothing about it," I exclaimed, considerably irritated. "Should you wish it, I'll settle with you now." And I drew my notebook from my pocket.
"No, no," he replied coolly. "You'll leave sufficient behind to cover your debts if you fail to return. I'm not in such a hurry. Sit down and take your dinner with us. A guest that is safe from repeating his visit can generally be made welcome.
Catherine, bring the things in. Where are you?"
Catherine reappeared, bearing a tray of knives and forks.
"You may get your dinner with Joseph," muttered Heathcliff aside, "and remain in the kitchen till he is gone."
She obeyed his directions very punctually. Perhaps she had no temptation to transgress. Living among clowns and misanthropists, she probably cannot appreciate a better class of people when she meets them. With Mr. Heathcliff grim and saturnine on one hand, and Hareton absolutely dumb on the other, I made a somewhat cheerless meal and bade adieu early. I would have departed by the back way to get a last glimpse of Catherine and annoy old Joseph, but Hareton received orders to lead up my horse, and my host himself escorted me to the door, so I could not fulfil my wish. How dreary life gets over in that house, I reflected while riding down the road. What a realization of something more romantic than a fairy tale it would have been for Mrs. Linton Heathcliff, had she and I struck up an attachment, as her good nurse desired, and migrated together into the stirring atmosphere of the town.
Chapter 32
1802. This September I was invited to devastate the moors of a friend in the north, and on my journey to his abode, I unexpectedly came within 15 miles of Gimmerton. The ostler at the roadside public house was holding a pail of water to refresh my horses, when a cart of very green oats, newly reaped, passed by, and he remarked,
"Yon's from Gimmerton, now. They're all as three wick, after other folk wi' their harvest."
"Gimmerton?" I repeated. My residence in that locality had already grown dim and dreamy.
Ah, I know. How far is it from this?
Up in 14 mile-hour ills and a rough road, he answered. A sudden impulse seized me to visit Thrushcross Grange. It was scarcely noon, and I conceived that I might as well pass the night under my own roof as in an inn. Besides, I could spare a day easily to arrange matters with my landlord, and thus save myself the trouble of invading the neighbourhood again. Having rested a while, I directed my servant to inquire the way to the village, and, with great fatigue to our beasts, we managed the distance in some 3 hours. I left him there, and proceeded down the valley alone. The grey church looked greyer, and the lonely churchyard lonelier. I distinguished a moor sheep cropping the short turf on the graves. It was sweet, warm weather, too warm for travelling, but the heat did not hinder me from enjoying the delightful scenery above and below. Had I seen it nearer August, I'm sure it would have tempted me to waste a month among its solitudes. In winter, nothing more dreary. In summer, nothing more divine than those glens shut in by hills, and those bluff, bold swells of heath. I reached the Grange before sunset, and knocked for admittance, but the family had retreated into the back premises. I judged by one thin blue wreath curling from the kitchen chimney, and they did not hear. I rode into the court. Under the porch, a girl of 9 or 10 sat knitting, and an old woman reclined on the house step, smoking a meditative pipe. "Is Mrs. Dean within?" I demanded of the dame.
"Mistress Dean? Nay," she answered. "She doesn't bide here. She's up at tights."
"Are you the housekeeper, then?" I continued.
"Aye, I keep the house,"
she replied. "Well, I'm Mr. Lockwood, the master. Are there any rooms to lodge me in, I wonder? I wish to stay all night."
"Master?"
she cried in astonishment.
"What? Whoever knew you were coming? You should have sent word. There's nowt another dry and immenseful about place. Nowt there isn't."
She threw down her pipe and bustled in. The girl followed, and I entered too, soon perceiving that her report was true, and moreover that I had almost upset her wits by my unwelcome apparition. I bade her be composed. I would go out for a walk, and meantime she must try to prepare a corner of a sitting-room for me to sup in, and a bedroom to sleep in. No sweeping and dusting, only good fire and dry sheets were necessary. She seemed willing to do her best, though she thrust the hearth-brush into the grates in mistake for the poker, and malappropriated several other articles of her craft. But I retired, confiding in her energy for a resting place against my return. Wuthering Heights was the goal of my proposed excursion. An afterthought brought me back, when I had quitted the court. "All well at the Heights?" I inquired of the woman.
"Aye, for aught we know,"
she answered, scurrying away with a pan of hot cinders. I would have asked why Mrs. Dean had deserted the Grange, but it was impossible to delay her at such a crisis. So I turned away and made my exit, rambling leisurely along, with the glow of a sinking sun behind, and the mild glory of a rising moon in front, one fading and the other brightening. As I quitted the park and climbed the stony by-road branching off to Mr. Heathcliff's dwelling, before I arrived in sight of it, all that remained of day was a beamless amber light along the west, but I could see every pebble on the path and every blade of grass by that splendid moon. I had neither to climb the gate nor to knock. It yielded to my hand. That is an improvement, I thought. And I noticed another, by the aid of my nostrils. A fragrance of stocks and wallflowers wafted on the air from amongst the homely fruit trees. Both doors and lattices were open, and yet, as is usually the case in a coal district, a fine red fire illumined the chimney. The comfort which the eye derives from it renders the extra heat endurable. But the house of Wuthering Heights is so large that the inmates have plenty of space for withdrawing out of its influence. and accordingly what inmates there were had stationed themselves not far from one of the windows. I could both see them and hear them talk before I entered, and looked and listened in consequence, being moved thereto by a mingled sense of curiosity and envy that grew as I lingered.
"Contrary,"
said a voice as sweet as a silver bell.
"That for the third time, you dunce."
"I'm not going to tell you again. Recollect, or I'll pull your hair."
"Contrary, then," answered another in deep but softened tones. "And now kiss me for minding so well. No, read it over first correctly, without a single mistake."
The male speaker began to read. He was a young man, respectably dressed and seated at a table, having a book before him. His handsome features glowed with pleasure, and his eyes kept impatiently wandering from the page to a small white hand over his shoulder, which recalled him by a smart slap on the cheek whenever its owner detected such signs of inattention. Its owner stood behind, her light shining ringlets blending at intervals with his brown locks, as she bent to superintend his studies. And her face, it was lucky he could not see her face, or he would never have been so steady. I could, and I bit my lip in spite, at having thrown away the chance I might have had of doing something besides staring at its smiting beauty. The task was done, not free from further blunders, but the pupil claimed a reward, and received at least 5 kisses, which, however, he generously returned. Then they came to the door, and from their conversation I judged they were about to issue out and have a walk on the moors. I supposed I should be condemned in Hareton Earnshaw's heart, if not by his mouth, to the lowest pit in the infernal regions, if I showed my unfortunate person in his neighbourhood then. And feeling very mean and malignant, I skulked round to seek refuge in the kitchen. There was unobstructed admittance on that side also, and at the door sat my old friend Nellie Dean, sewing and singing a song, which was often interrupted from within by harsh words of scorn and intolerance, uttered in far from musical accents.
"I'd rather by earth have them swearing in me lugs from morning to night, nor hearken ye a siver,"
said the tenant of the kitchen, in answer to an unheard speech of Nelly's.
"It's a blazing shame that I cannot open blessed book, but ye set up them glories to Satan, and all to flace and wickedness that ever were born into the world. Ah, you're a right nout, and choose another, and that poor lad'll be lost atween ye, poor lad,"
he added with a groan.
"His witch I'm certain on't. Oh, Lord, judge him, for there's neither law nor justice among we're rulers."
"No, or we should be sitting in flaming faggots, I suppose," retorted the singer. "But whist, old man, and read your Bible like a Christian, and never mind me. This is Fairy Annie's Wedding, a bonny tune. It goes to a dance."
Mrs. Dean was about to recommence when I advanced, and recognizing me directly, she jumped to her feet, crying,
"Why, bless you, Mr. Lockwood! How could you think of returning in this way? All's shut up at Thrushcross Grange. You should have given us notice."
"I've arranged to be accommodated there for as long as I shall stay," I answered. "I depart again tomorrow. And how are you transplanted here, Mrs. Dean? Tell me that."
"Zillah left, and Mr. Heathcliff wished me to come, soon after you went to London, and stay till you returned."
"But step in, pray. Have you walked from Gimmerton this evening?"
"From the Grange," I replied. "And while they make me lodging room there, I want to finish my business with your master, because I don't think of having another opportunity in a hurry."
"What business, sir?"
said Nelly, conducting me into the house.
"He's gone out at present and won't return soon."
"About the rent," I answered.
"Oh, then it is with Mrs. Heathcliff you must settle,"
she observed.
"Or rather, with me. She has not learnt to manage her affairs yet, and I act for her. There's nobody else."
I looked surprised.
"Ah, you have not heard of Heathcliff's death, I see,"
she continued, Heathcliff dead? I exclaimed, astonished. How long ago?
3 months since. But sit down and let me take your hat, and I'll tell you all about it. Stop, you have had nothing to eat, have you?
I want nothing. I've ordered supper at home. You sit down too. I never dreamt of his dying. Let me hear how it came to pass. You say you don't expect them back for some time, the young people.
No, I have to scold them every evening for their late rambles. But they don't care for me. At least have a drink of our old ale. It will do you good. You seem weary.
She hastened to fetch it before I could refuse, and I heard Joseph asking whether...
It weren't a crying scandal that she should have followers at her time of life. And then to get them jocks out at Master's cellar, he fair shame to bide still and see it.
She did not stay to retaliate, but re-entered in a minute, bearing a reaming silver pint, whose contents I lauded with becoming earnestness. And afterwards, she furnished me with the sequel of Heathcliff's history. He had a queer end, as she expressed it.
I was summoned to Wuthering Heights within a fortnight of you leaving us, she said, and I obeyed joyfully for Catherine's sake. My first interview with her grieved and shocked me. She had altered so much since our separation. Mr. Heathcliff did not explain his reasons for taking a new mind about my coming here. He only told me he wanted me, and he was tired of seeing Catherine. I must make the little parlour my sitting room and keep her with me. It was enough if he were obliged to see her once or twice a day. She seemed pleased at this arrangement, and by degrees I smuggled over a great number of books and other articles that had formed her amusement at the Grange, and flattered myself we should get on in tolerable comfort. The delusion did not last long. Catherine, contented at first, in a brief space grew irritable and restless. For one thing, she was forbidden to move out of the garden, and it fretted her sadly to be confined to its narrow bounds as spring drew on. For another, in following the house, I was forced to quit her frequently, and she complained of loneliness. She preferred quarrelling with Joseph in the kitchen to sitting at peace in her solitude. I did not mind their skirmishes, but Hareton was often obliged to seek the kitchen also, when the master wanted to have the house to himself, and though in the beginning she either left it at his approach, or quietly joined in my occupations, and shunned remarking or addressing him, and, though he was always as sullen and silent as possible, after a while she changed her behaviour,